Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Oklahoma Center for Humanities will host a book launch and signing for my guest today, Kristen Ortel, the Barnard Professor of American History at the University of Tulsa. Ortel has written a new biography of an American figure whose historical exploits were truly remarkable and heroic, but whose story today has become intertwined with myth and legend. Harriet Tubman, Slavery, the Civil War, and Civil Rights in the 19th Century, documents Tubman's life and work, first leading family and friends to freedom through the Underground Railroad, later as a Civil War nurse, scout, and spy, and yet a third career championing the women's right to vote by the end of the 19th century. Ortel is the Barnard Associate Professor of 19th Century American History at the University of Tulsa. She's also the author of Bleeding Borders, Race, Gender, and Violence in Pre-Civil War Kansas, and co-author of Frontier Feminists, Clarina Howard Nichols and the Politics of Motherhood. She'll be speaking about her latest book on Harriet Tubman at a book launch event this Thursday at 7 o'clock at the Terrell Hall Auditorium on the TU campus, and the event is free and open to the public. Kristen Ortel, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rich.
And congratulations on the new book on Harriet Tubman. What interested you in Harriet Tubman?
Well, you know, I've always been interested in Tubman. I think many Americans learn about her as a child, reading the one of over 100 children's and youth biographies that have been published on Tubman. And she's such an important historical figure. But as I started looking in the recent scholarship about her, there have been very few books written for an adult audience. And there had been some excellent biographies written a little over a decade ago, but they were very long, very academic in orientation, and I wanted to write something shorter and more accessible for the general reading public, and in particular for, you know, college freshmen, for example.
Mm-hmm. This is part of the Routledge Historical American series, which mm-hmm. is actually edited by a former University of Tulsa professor, Paul Finkelman.
Yes.
And one of the things when you tackle somebody like Harriet Tubman is separating legend from fact. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Harriet Tubman, because many of those hundreds of children's and youth biographies, these stories get told over and they get changed a little bit over mm-hmm. time. And pretty soon it's like you're dealing with, to a degree, like somebody like Davy Crockett, where no one knows where the fact ends and fiction begins.
Right.
So what was your task as a historian?
Well, that was one of my main goals, is to weed out the myth and really tell a history that was accurate, but also didn't take away from the heroism that she did enact. And so, for instance, the commonly noted figure of 300 slaves. If you look in any of the children's biographies or the websites that are out there, even today, in fact, I looked at a USA Today article from about 5 years ago that cited that 300 slaves figure as, you know, she single-handedly led 300 slaves to freedom, and that's just not true. The best historical research indicates that before the war, she facilitated about 70 to 75 slaves and their efforts into freedom.
And you think about that, you're not going to take 20 people out at a time or 30
right.
people. You're going to take two or three, four or five people tops.
Right. It was incredibly risky and dangerous. And the larger your party, the more diverse your party in terms of age, made it even more difficult. So her typical party was, you know, two people, maybe three. The largest party she ever led out of freedom was 11. And that was incredibly remarkable that that party was successful, given its size and also given the fact that there was a baby in that party as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing that when you deal with Harriet Tubman, there are relatively few primary sources. She did speak to people very late in life.
Yes.
And they were very much reminiscences, which, you know, as historians know, that when somebody is late in life, they're studying the story the way they want the story told.
Exactly.
And you have to sort of take it with a grain of salt and confirm everything it's said. That's very difficult with somebody like Harriet Tubman.
Yes. And, I mean, the fact is she was illiterate for her entire life. There are indications that she tried to learn to read a couple of times and just basically gave up and said it's not worth it. And she obviously was incredibly successful without being literate, so she didn't really see the need for it. But unfortunately for historians, that means she left no records, no letters, no diary entries, none of the sources that we typically rely on to reconstruct someone's life story are available for Tubman. So it is a creative endeavor to reconstruct her life.
So how do you reconstruct her life? Is it based on other people's writings of meeting her? I would assume that at least for a while, the people who were helping, abetting her in taking people to freedom,
yes,
were also not writing this down because it could be used against them.
Yes. Yeah, so especially during, you know, her most significant time period, the 1850s, when she was making all these secret trips back into the South, there are very few records. But some agents on the Underground Railroad did record her movements. And we've been able to find those records, for instance, in the New York Historical Society. They found a record book by Sidney Gay, who was an Underground Railroad director in New York City. And he has a couple of different entries that describe in detail Tubman's arrival, the members of her party, their ages, their names, if possible. But again, a lot of these runaways changed their names after running away to avoid detection. So it is very difficult detective work to pull things together. But yeah, I rely on other people's reminiscences or letters that mention meeting her or talking about her at the time. Also newspaper articles. She was quite famous beginning in the late 1850s. So there are newspaper articles, particularly in abolitionist newspapers, that write about her and her endeavors.
Yeah. Now, what do we know about Harriet Tubman's early life? She was up on the Maryland Eastern Shore for the most part. That was where she grew up, very, very close to freedom. You know, I mean, very close to the Mason-Dixon line.
Yes, yeah. She grew up on the Eastern Shore of Maryland. We know, for example, now, 15 years ago, we didn't know her exact birth date. Now we know that she was born in March of 1821. Because a historian, Kate Clifford Larson, came across a receipt that was recorded by her master that he paid a certain amount of money to a midwife to deliver a baby girl. And we know that her mother, Rit, or her full name was Harriet, her mother, Rit, was pregnant at that time. And so we put two and two together and figured out that was her actual birth date. So, yes, she grew up in Maryland, which was on the border of slavery, but it was still very much entrenched in the old Chesapeake plantation system. And she was asked to do work that was very typical of even male slaves, hauling wood, working in the fields, doing very heavy labor.
And from all accounts, she didn't submit very well to authority.
No, she didn't.
And in fact, one of the most famous aspects of her life, this wound she had in her head, which you write about, said, you know, she may have seen visions. She was seeing visions. And it sort of, it also had a narcolepsy, which many people would write, you know, all of a sudden, boom, she goes to sleep.
Yeah. Yeah, this injury to the head that she received, we think around age 13, resulted from her refusal to help her master capture a fugitive slave. A fellow slave had run off the plantation, and her overseer was after this slave, and she stood in front of the doorway, and the overseer threw, we think, probably a lead paperweight at the door to try to catch the slave, and it hit Harriet instead. And she suffered from what we now know was probably some kind of seizure disability for her entire life, which would cause this narcolepsy. So it makes her achievements even more remarkable, given that she really had a physical disability her entire life.
And really, that refusal to submit to authority sort of led to her career as this sort of conductor on the Underground Railroad, because her owner was considering selling her.
Yes. Yes. And this is typical. And I just want to say, Tubman, yes, is a heroic figure, but on the other hand, she's very typical of many slaves in that they resisted slavery at every opportunity. And often those runaways who actually left the plantation permanently often did so because there was a rumor of their sale. These slaves are very attached to their family members, and if they're going to be wrenched away from their families, they're going to do it on their own terms. And so Tubman heard rumors that her master was selling her, And she said, I'm sorry, I'm not going to the Deep South. I'm not going to a chain gang in Louisiana or Mississippi. I'm going to seek my freedom. And that's when she first escaped in 1849.
Yeah, and she actually took her brothers on the first attempt, and the brothers said, let's go back.
Yes, yes. So three of them left, and according to all accounts, her brothers talked her into going back. And so a couple weeks later, actually about a month later, they returned, and then Harriet decided to go it alone after that.
Now, there was a really interesting fact in that first escape, which sort of gave me new insight in how this relationship, the plantation relationship, worked, because the owner didn't post her as a runaway for several weeks, mm-hmm. which suggested to me that it was not uncommon for a slave to leave for a week or so and come back. And you also recount this story about religion in slavery practice, and I think the common perception is it was always stamped out, and it wasn't always stamped out. You document stories of slaves leaving their residence, walking for long distance to go hear a preacher, then mm-hmm. walking back to be at work on Monday.
Yes, absolutely. I think we're discovering now that the way slavery functioned and the controls put in place by masters were often flexible. And they had to be. And so, yes, slaves would run away for a day, 2 days, 3 days, even a week. And if they returned on their own accord, you know, they might receive a punishment, certainly, but it might not be as severe as if it was in the immediate aftermath of whatever infraction took place. So if you break a tool and your overseer sees you, you might get whipped right there on the spot. But if you evade that initial sort of violent anger, you might buy yourself some time, and your master actually might be grateful that you've returned on your own accord, and they don't have to spend the money to put an ad in the paper and set the paddy rollers after you.
Yeah. I think we think of this like almost a concentration camp atmosphere, and I'm sure in many parts of the South it was. Mm-hmm. But do you think this is more a function of this sort of border culture?
I think things were more flexible on the border between slavery and freedom. But I also think that slaves had a lot more agency and a lot more power than we have given them credit for. That's not to diminish the oppression they experienced in any way or the violence, but they were able to assert their humanity. And, you know, of course, a classic example of this is claiming their own religion, as you mentioned. And they would often say, hey, you know, there's a preacher in the nearby county and I want a pass to go see that preacher. And they would leave for a day or two. You know, those are privileges that masters would allow in return for obedience during the work week.
Now, did that change in the years approaching the Civil War, especially like after the Fugitive Slave Act and you have all this violence around slavery,
yes,
say, in Kansas?
Yes, absolutely. And that's, again, why Tubman is interesting, because it is the decade of the 1850s that is most extreme and where masters are most concerned about keeping their slaves on the plantation, and where really the federal government, North and South, is enacting laws and policies to control slaves and their movement.
Yeah, and some of them are in the interest of saving the Union. Others are just in the interest, just as we make laws against all sorts of refugees today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So she finally gets to freedom on her second attempt. What convinces her to go back and to grab, was it family members?
Absolutely, it's her family. Like anyone, she wanted to reconstitute her family in freedom. She was lonely. Even though she had freedom, she missed her parents. She missed her brothers and sisters. And so that really is the guiding light for her, and she literally does not stop until her entire family is rescued. And unfortunately, the last time she returns to Maryland, right before the war, she goes to get her last sister that is remaining in slavery, and after she arrives, she finds out that her sisters died. And I'm sure she was crestfallen because of that, but she could take comfort in the fact that the rest of her family members lived in upstate New York or Canada, thanks to her.
My guest today is Kristen Ortel, the Barnard Professor of American History at the University of Tulsa. Her new book is titled Harriet Tubman, Slavery, the Civil War, and Civil Rights in the 19th Century. She'll be speaking about this this Thursday at 7 o'clock in Terrell Hall Auditorium for a book launch and lecture. here on the University of Tulsa campus that is free, and I guess there'll be books for purchase as well.
Yes.
And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. One of the really interesting stories of her going back to get family is going back to get John Tubman and what she discovered when she went back for him.
Yes, she had saved up money working in Pennsylvania and had purchased a brand new suit to give to her husband, John Tubman. And she returned to the Eastern Shore and found out that he had taken up with another woman. And, of course, marriage was not legal for slaves, so they weren't legally married, but they certainly considered themselves married. And at this point, John perhaps did not even know where she was, if she was coming back, when she was coming back, or perhaps he had decided that it was too risky to live in freedom, and he didn't want to live with that uncertainty of possibly being recaptured and returned. And so I think he just kind of resolved to live with his situation, and he found another woman, and she was devastated and angry. But she decided it's freedom is more important than love at this point, and she decided to make the best of it and ended up helping two or three other slaves to freedom during that trip.
Now, when she would go on these trips, was it mainly to rescue family members and a few strangers came along for the journey who were willing to go?
Yeah, family members, that was typically the motivation to return. But often other people would find out she was going to be in the area and they would ask to be included. And she would agree to facilitate their process as well.
And give us a sense of what a sample journey from the Maryland Eastern Shore to wherever she would drop these people off.
Goodness,
it's upstate New York?
Yes.
Or later in, all the way to Canada?
Yes. You know, I went to the Eastern Shore of Maryland when I was doing research for the book, and the terrain in this area is very swampy, is thick with trees. You cannot see a darn thing when you're in the midst of one of these cypress forests, right? So the fact that she found her way out of Maryland and then would trek typically through Delaware or and then up through Philadelphia in Pennsylvania, where a lot of Quaker allies lived, and then up to upstate New York. Perhaps she would go through New York first, but usually it was just straight through upstate New York. She ended up having a kind of a home base in Auburn, New York, a tiny town west of Syracuse.
She was actually given a home by William Seward, who would later challenge Abraham Lincoln for the 1860 presidential Republican nomination and be Lincoln's Secretary of State.
Yeah, she actually purchased the home from Seward. He gave her a very good rate. They literally were neighbors. If you go to Auburn, New York now, you can visit Harriet Tubman's home, and you can also visit Seward's home, and they're just down the street from each other. So it gives you a sense of the interracial cooperation that existed and that made the Underground Railroad so successful. So from Auburn, then she would continue north to St. Catharines, which is now Western Ontario, Canada. And even in the middle of winter, she would make these treks on foot the entire time. And again, it's just remarkable, the physical strength, but also the mental acuity to be able to plan these routes and the food and supplies necessary to actually make them successful.
And you say by the late 1850s, the abolitionist press is writing about her, so she has become a celebrity of sorts.
Yes.
I mean, obviously.
And a wanted woman.
Yeah. William Seward is a former governor of New York, so it's like, you know, this is not just any old Joe selling her house at a good rate.
Yeah.
She's very much part of this abolitionist establishment. Mm-hmm. So not only would she have been well-known in the North, she would have been well-known in the South for equally and opposite reasons.
Yes.
Yes.
And there were wanted posters. Again, this is another one of the myths. Some people say $12,000 was advertised for her life, for her capture. And that's just not true. We haven't found any evidence of $12,000. But we do know that, you know, like any runaway, she was advertised and there were financial rewards for her capture.
And I think the thing was that slave owners feared her throughout the South. Was it mainly just these border areas of Maryland and Delaware and that area?
I think they feared Tubman only in those areas, but slave owners everywhere feared runaways. And Tubman wasn't the only one to return into the South and help others to freedom. I found examples of a slave in Missouri who went to Iowa and found, you know, his freedom in Iowa and was living there, but decided to return and get his wife and children. So there were threats of runaways throughout the South, and in fact, it is the most vexing problem for slave owners in the 1850s.
Now, after the Fugitive Slave Act, it becomes equally illegal to help a slave in the North, even though there isn't slavery in that particular state. It's certainly illegal to help a slave. It would probably be illegal to sell a slave, escaped slave, property at a good rate, as Seward did. But were there pockets of places in the United States where basically the rules didn't apply?
Well, yes, it depended upon which community. And I think I included a document at the end of the book that narrates the capture of Charles Nall, who was a runaway, a fugitive slave who was camped out in Troy, New York. And the community in Troy basically decided, we will not let the marshals come and arrest him and return him into slavery in Virginia. And they wrested him away from the police and took him to Canada eventually. And Tubman was part of that rescue attempt. So, but there were other communities, even in Boston, you know, that would turn in fugitive slaves to the local jail.
And there were tasked marshals from the South who were roaming the North, basically looking for escaped slaves.
Yeah. But even local Northern police forces were by law obligated to put a known fugitive slave in jail and notify his or her owner and return them to slavery.
Now, you also account of another story, which I knew that they were somewhat associated, but I didn't realize they were as close as your book suggests, which is Harriet Tubman knew John Brown quite well.
Yes, she did.
Did some fundraising for him.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when John Brown made his ill-attempted raid at Harper's Ferry, he was expecting Harriet Tubman to be there.
Yes, he was. He admired Tubman greatly. In fact, I used the phrase General Tubman.
I've heard this phrase about her, yeah.
And he's the one who dubbed her General. In fact, he compared her to a man in the sense that he thought she was as courageous and as strong as any man he'd ever known. And he meant it as a compliment. In the mid-19th century, being mannish was not a compliment. But taken from John Brown, I think she embraced that compliment, and she admired him greatly, too. She believed he was completely 100% an abolitionist in a way that no other white person could be. And I think in part that's because they both connected on a religious level. They were both very ensconced in evangelical Christianity, and they did believe that they were enacting God's purpose in their lives by defeating slavery.
And yet she didn't go to Harper's Ferry.
No, she didn't. As far as we can tell, she was probably ill, and that's why. But it's also possibly that she agreed with others that it was not a very effective plan, or the plan would not be successful.
Crazy.
and on the day of the raid, she had a premonition that something was wrong. She didn't know exactly what day the raid would occur, but the morning of the raid, she woke up and told a friend, "I think Brown is in trouble." And sure enough, she found out the next day that the raid had failed.
Now, once the Civil War broke out, you would think that the Union would automatically want to use somebody of Harriet Tubman's talents. But really, like a lot of abolitionists, the Union really didn't know what to do with abolitionists as the war began. Mm-hmm. And I think perhaps it was a feeling that we're going to try to bring the South back into the fold very quickly, and slavery will not be abolished in the South anytime soon. But eventually she does play a role in the Civil War.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Lincoln and the Union approach initially was not about abolishing slavery. It was about restoring the Union It was about keeping the border states in the union if possible. And so any gesture towards abolition or universal emancipation was ill-advised, according to the Republicans. But Tubman really held Lincoln's feet to the fire on the emancipation issue. She criticized him early in the war and basically said, "Master Lincoln doesn't know what he's doing. If he did know, the quickest route to victory would be to emancipate the slaves and arm them." And in fact, that's what ends up happening.
Yes, but very late in the war.
Yeah, 1862. Summer of 62 when Lincoln's generals start encouraging him to shift his view about emancipation and urge him to arm black slaves.
And so what role did she play during the war?
So she was sent to the Department of the South, which is South Carolina, Florida, and Georgia. And she worked mostly out of Beaufort, South Carolina. And she first served as a nurse and a laundress among mostly black troops and contraband, that is, escaped black slaves who would run to Union lines. And then she, obviously, her talents were recognized immediately. Oh, this is the Harriet Tubman we've heard about. I bet she's a good spy. Well, of course, she was an excellent spy. So, and she was trusted by the local black population. There was, again, a mythology about her. People had heard about her. So she was able to go into the local plantations and say, "Look, the Union Army is close. We're going to fight the Confederate Army at this point or on this date, and we need your help." So that intelligence really culminated in the Combahee River raid in June of 1863. And she and Colonel James Montgomery led a raid up that river, which eventually garnered about 780 escaped slaves and caused roughly $1 million worth of property damage. So her and Montgomery's version of hard war was really the approach that eventually Sherman would become famous for. But Tubman and Montgomery initiated that style of warfare in South Carolina in 1863, and it was very effective.
What's really amazing is, you know, after the war, she's in upstate New York and eventually getting involved in the suffrage movement.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, black men got the right to vote in 1870, and that wasn't good enough for Tubman. In fact, she was a little peeved that black men got the vote before women did. So she was very committed to suffrage, particularly late in life. So many of the leaders of the women's suffrage movement had been abolitionists before the war and during the war. And so she had allies already in that movement.
So she fit right into this orbit.
Absolutely. She attended several conventions with Susan B. Anthony and spoke at them and supported women's suffrage.
Was she considered sort of like the elderly statesperson,
yes,
if you will?
Yes, yeah. The grandmother of the movement. Yeah. And for black women, black club women in the early 20th century revered her and invited her to their conventions as some kind of a figurehead.
Yeah. Well, it's a fascinating book. We wish you great success with it. Kristen, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rich.
Kristen Ortel is the Barnard Professor of American History at the University of Tulsa and the author of Harriet Tubman, Slavery, the Civil War, and Civil Rights in the 19th Century. It's published by Routledge. She'll be having a book launch event at Terrell Hall Auditorium on the TU campus Thursday evening at 7 o'clock. That event is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.